KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Hostages are being released to Israel, and fighting and airstrikes have stopped in Gaza. It's day one of a ceasefire. For Sunday, January 19th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, with the ceasefire in place, Palestinians in Gaza are preparing to return to homes they fled to escape the fighting.
To be honest, it's so overwhelming. I have never thought that this day would come, that I would make it out alive.
The moment comes on President Biden's last full day in office. We'll assess his legacy, and we'll look at how incoming President Trump made billions this weekend on cryptocurrency.
I think folks expect this coin will end up tracking the Trump presidency. So if he has great moments, it should go up in value. If it has bad moments, they might think that's a good time to buy.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Hurst. President-elect Donald Trump and his supporters celebrated the day before his inauguration with a rally in downtown Washington, D.C. tonight. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben has more.
The rally celebrated Trump's November win while also maintaining the MAGA identity of a movement that's continually fighting.
Once and for all, we're going to end the reign of a failed and corrupt political establishment in Washington, a failed administration. We're not going to take it anymore.
The hours-long rally featured performances from Kid Rock and the Village People, as well as appearances from actor Jon Voight and SpaceX CEO Elon Musk. Supporters will return on Monday to the arena, where they will be able to watch a live stream of Trump's inauguration after it was moved inside due to cold weather. The inauguration parade has also been moved inside the arena. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, Washington.
Three Israeli women held hostage in Gaza have been released and are back in Israel today, getting medical attention at a hospital, and another 30 are expected to be released over the next several weeks. And Israel has released nearly 100 Palestinian detainees and prisoners as part of the Gaza ceasefire agreement. And as NPR's Sarah McCammon reports, families of Israeli hostages are calling on the Trump administration to work toward bringing the remaining hostages home.
More than 90 hostages are believed to still be held captive by Hamas in Gaza, and many of their families have been putting pressure on world leaders to secure their release.
Bring them home now!
At a press conference on the National Mall, Jonathan Dekelchen, father of Israeli-American hostage Sagi Dekelchen, thanked both the Biden and incoming Trump administrations for working together on the deal.
We know their commitment, we feel their commitment, we need their commitment for all 98 to come home.
Dekelchen was joined by other families and former hostage Noah Argamani. She was rescued by Israeli forces in June, and her partner remains a hostage in Gaza. Sarah McCammon, NPR News, Washington.
Los Angeles fire crews have made progress in containing the deadly and destructive wildfires, but as Elise Hugh reports, about 80,000 people remain under evacuation orders.
Many Angelenos are eager to survey the damage in their neighborhoods and see what can be salvaged, but fire crews say repopulation won't happen until those areas are considered safe. Crews have to clean up toxic ash, hazardous waste, and make repairs to power and water infrastructure first. The Eaton and Palisades fires are the two most destructive in Southern California history, and another surge of Santa Ana winds are expected late Monday into Tuesday. For NPR News, I'm Elise Hugh in Los Angeles.
And those fires have been burning since January 7th. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. President Biden spent his final full day in office in South Carolina today, saying the fight to redeem America's soul is difficult and ongoing.
We must hold on to hope. We must stay engaged. We must always keep the faith in a better day to come.
This while reflecting on the influence of both the civil rights movement and the state itself in his political trajectory. Biden spoke at the Royal Missionary Baptist Church about his life in public service and being influenced by his political heroes, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy, as he thanked the state for its support, saying, "I owe you big." The early win in South Carolina in the 2020 Democratic Party helped catapult him to the White House. Homes and businesses are going to need a lot more electricity in the coming years, and NPR's Michael Copley reports it could make it harder to rein in climate change.
Power demand is rising because companies are building new data centers and factories, and because homes and businesses are buying things like cars and heat pumps that run on electricity. And more homes need air conditioning. For utilities that have to keep the lights on, the fossil fuel natural gas looks like a good way to meet that growing demand. And that could mean decades of additional emissions that are raising global temperatures. Market analysts say that may not lead to a spike in climate pollution since coal plants keep retiring. But scientists say the world needs to move a lot faster to cut heat-trapping emissions to avoid even more extreme impacts from climate change. Michael Copley, NPR News.
Wall Street is closed tomorrow in observance of the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantsFoundation.org. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Three female hostages from Israel, held by Hamas in Gaza for 15 months, were released today in an emotional first day of a ceasefire between Israel and the militant group. And just now, Israeli prison authorities say they have begun the release of almost 100 Palestinian prisoners and detainees as part of the agreement. It seeks to end more than 15 months of war in Gaza that began when Hamas attacking Israel and taking hostages. For more, NPR's Greg Myrie joins us now from Tel Aviv. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Scott.
All right, start off by telling us who was released today.
So these are three Israeli civilian women, ages 24 to 31, all seized by Hamas in the attack that ignited this war on October 7th, 2023. The Israel-Hamas deal calls for these staggered releases of hostages and prisoners, and Hamas freed these Israelis in a chaotic scene in Gaza City. Masked Hamas gunmen drove a van carrying the women into a crowded square in the city, jam-packed with Palestinians. The women were handed over to the Red Cross, which in turn delivered them to the Israeli military. They were then whisked back to Israel and all greeted with big hugs by their mothers.
That must have been emotional.
Absolutely. The Israeli women were flown by a helicopter to the hospital near Tel Aviv and received a rousing welcome. They were all able to walk on their own, and some of the photos released by the Israeli military showed them smiling. In one photo, one of the women, Emily Damari, held up her bandaged left hand to show that two fingers were missing. They were apparently lost when she was shot the day she was captured more than 15 months ago. And Scott, it's hard to overstate how much Israelis have invested emotionally in getting the hostages home. It's a constant topic of discussion in the media. Billboards and posters are everywhere. There's regular rallies in the main square in Tel Aviv. So today was a huge deal, though more than 90 hostages remain.
Okay, so Israel says it's only just now releasing almost 100 prisoners as part of the agreement. This is after a delay of many hours. It's very late at night there. What more do we know about this latest delay?
This delay is reminiscent of one of the other hostage and prisoner swaps in early in the war in November of 2023. The number of Palestinians being released then was also larger than the number of Israelis, and it took a long time to process the Palestinians. So this may be a scenario we're going to see time and again in the coming weeks. And as the ceasefire took effect earlier in the day, Palestinian civilians celebrated in the streets of Gaza. Some waved Hamas flags and chanted Hamas slogans. Some Hamas fighters with their weapons came out in the open. So this is just anecdotal based on what we saw in public today. But clearly, Hamas remains a substantial presence in Gaza.
And here in the U.S., it's President Biden's last full day in office. He spoke about the war today. What did he have to say?
Yeah, he said that, quote, After so much pain, destruction, and loss of life, today the guns in Gaza have gone silent. Biden and his team long sought a ceasefire here, and the one reached this past week was virtually identical to what Biden proposed way back in May. Yet President-elect Trump claimed credit, saying he was the one who helped push this across the finish line. And to sort of drive that home, the family of one hostage who was released issued a statement expressing gratitude to Trump. But the statement made no mention of Biden or any Israeli political leaders.
That's NPR's Greg Myrie in Tel Aviv. Thanks, Greg.
Sure. Thanks, Scott.
And later in the show, we will talk to someone in Gaza about what day one of the ceasefire has been like there. President Biden is spending the last full day of his presidency in South Carolina. As Biden has said repeatedly, without South Carolina, he never would have been president. That was the pivotal state that helped revive Biden's fledgling campaign in the 2020 presidential primaries. Tomorrow, Biden's predecessor and now successor, Donald Trump, will take the oath of office and return to the White House. And to mark this moment, we are joined by somebody who can give us the long view on Biden. NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid, who along with me covered that Biden 2020 campaign, his time in the White House. Asma covered that truncated run for a second term. Hey there, Asma.
Hey there, Scott.
So you and I were covering it earlier this week. The president gave his goodbye, a farewell address from the Oval Office.
After 50 years of public service, I give you my word. I still believe in the idea for which this nation stands. Nation where the strength of our institutions and the character of our people matter and must endure.
Now, Asma, Biden has been trying in many different ways to shape his legacy on his way out the door. He tried to do that in this speech, but it was also interesting. He had a dire warning.
He did. And Scott, it was a warning that genuinely surprised me.
Today, an oligarchy is taking shape in America of extreme wealth, power, and influence that literally threatens our entire democracy.
And that word, oligarchy, I mean, that is the first time that he has used the idea of an oligarchy in an American context. He went on to warn against the idea of a, quote, tech industrial complex. He said there's a small group of ultra-rich people who have too much power in the country, and he said that it could have dangerous consequences for misinformation and for policies like climate. You know, Scott, what was so striking to me about this final speech is that he did not explicitly ring the alarm bells about the next president. He didn't name check Donald Trump once.
And that was so interesting because he raised that alarm so many times throughout his time in office, and it seemed like one of his major goals was to turn the page on Donald Trump. Obviously, that didn't happen. And I think that gets to the next question, Asma. On one hand, when you talk to Biden and his allies, and I feel like you especially heard a lot of this past summer when he dropped out of the race, his allies will make the argument, Joe Biden is one of the most consequential presidents of the last half century when it comes to things signed into law. And at the same time, Joe Biden is somebody throughout almost the entirety of his presidency, he was deeply unpopular. He leaves office deeply unpopular with the American public. How do you sort through that?
Well, let's start with the approval ratings. I mean, you are right that a majority of Americans disapprove of how Biden has performed as president on a whole range of issues. You know, you can look at the economy, immigration. But at the same time, Biden has invested billions of dollars in infrastructure projects with the goal to make more things in America. And the other night in that farewell speech, he tried to make the case that it's going to take time for this all to really be understood.
It will take time to feel the full impact of all we've done together. But the seeds are planted, and they'll grow and they'll bloom for decades to come.
You know, but right now, in this moment, people see Biden as a one-term president who had really hoped to turn the page on Donald Trump. He had described Trump as a threat to democracy, but now, of course, we are seeing Donald Trump return to the White House.
Any thoughts on why, ultimately, Biden was so unpopular?
You know, he is often blamed, particularly among Republicans, for inflation. And while, you know, yes, the White House could have recognized people's financial pain perhaps more quickly, controlling inflation is largely the purview of the Federal Reserve. And Biden believes deeply in the independence of the Fed. I will say, Scott, there are, you know, a number of issues that made Biden unpopular. I think you could look, for example, at the war in Gaza. Mm-hmm. He was routinely protested by people on the left as he traveled the country. You know, he did manage to get this ceasefire hostage deal through last week, just as he was leaving office. But it is a plan that the incoming president, Donald Trump, is taking credit for. And I think it's a valid question whether or not this deal would have actually happened without Trump. His Middle East envoy was also involved in the negotiations, and Trump had said that if the hostages were not freed by his inauguration, there would be hell to pay.
So let's get to the big question that so many Democrats have been, frankly, angry about over the past year. Given that unpopularity, given Biden's advanced age, why did he decide to run for re-election initially?
You know, Biden didn't seem to understand the mood in the country. And I will say he seemed out of touch, perhaps even with parts of his own party. You know, many people, including Democrats, thought that he would be too old, 86 years old, at the end of a possible second term. When he ran back in 2020, given his age, the thought was that he was going to be a one-term president. And last summer, shortly after he bombed that debate against Trump, he held a press conference, and I asked him about his decision to run for re-election.
In 2020, you referred to yourself as being a bridge candidate for a younger, fresher generation of Democratic leaders, and I wanted to know what changed.
What changed was the gravity of the situation I inherited in terms of the economy, our foreign policy, and domestic division.
I think, Scott, what this comes down to is the fact that Biden felt that he was the best option to defeat Trump. You know, but that decision to insist on running for re-election and not drop out until July prevented a real Democratic primary from taking place, and it shortened up the campaign for his party.
Let's end with the long view. Let's zoom out. What do you think some of the accomplishments are that Biden will be remembered for? What do you think, as he said in that clip we heard earlier, are some of the things that maybe won't come into fruition for a long period of time, but will be Biden administration accomplishments?
You know, whether or not you approve of Biden as president, it is an accurate assessment that he has made certainly massive investments in things like infrastructure, clean energy, and semiconductors. Most presidents get one major bill through Congress in their first term. Biden managed to get several legislative wins through to really reach these sort of historic levels of spending, not just, you know, to improve bridges and airports, but to fundamentally make more things in America so that the United States doesn't rely on competitors like China for some of the things that that he sees as being really vital for national security. You know, for years, there was this idea of industrial policy, and that is the idea of using huge infusion of government money to reshape the economy. And it was taboo here in Washington. Biden, though, openly embraced it, and that also spurred investments from private companies. A whole range of new projects and investments have been announced in a range of states, in a range of places, including a number of Republican-controlled congressional districts.
That is NPR's Asma Khalid. Asma, I feel like it was just yesterday and also 1,000 years ago that you and I were in those Wilmington parking lots covering those strange COVID-era rallies that Biden held as he ran for president. Nice to talk to you on his final day in office. Thank you.
Nice to speak with you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Three female hostages released from Gaza are now in Israel in the first test of a fragile ceasefire with Hamas. A gradual release of 33 hostages over the next 6 weeks is expected, and Israel has agreed to release almost 2,000 Palestinian prisoners and detainees. There is hope that the ceasefire will bring an end to the 15-month war that started when Hamas attacked Israel, killing some 1,200 and kidnapping more than 250. President-elect Donald Trump is in Washington for several events ahead of his inauguration tomorrow, including laying a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Arlington National Cemetery earlier today before holding a rally at an arena in D.C. And President Biden is spending his last full day as president in South Carolina, urging Americans to, quote, keep the faith in a better day to come. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. After more than 15 months of war, a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas went into effect today. Israeli hostages held captive for more than a year are being released, and the airstrikes and attacks in Gaza have halted. While it's only just begun, many people are happy that the hostilities have eased for now. One of them is Noura El-Assi. She's a journalist and a student from Gaza City, though she has been displaced since the very beginning of the war. Noura joins me now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Hello. I'm so glad to be here.
Let me just begin by asking how you're feeling today and what the atmosphere is like around you.
Well, it's full of joy and celebrations. And to be honest, it's so overwhelming. I have never thought that this day would come, that I would make it out alive. You know, the past 15 months have been brutal. It's not that I lost hope, but I did not think I would make it out alive. But thank God I am.
I mean, so many people in Gaza have been displaced, have seen attacks and violence and death and destruction every day for 15 months. What are the conversations that you're having right now with people that you're coming across today? What kind of things are you talking about?
Well, it's mostly about going back home. That is the main topic here. We have been displaced out of our home for almost over a year. And it's so overwhelming to have this idea that we will go back there because we thought, like, we could never go back to the north, to our own country, to our houses. Though many people, I have heard, like, a lot, I don't know the right percentage for it, but have lost their homes. So they will be going back to rubbles. But fortunately for me, our house is still standing, alhamdulillah. But there has been some destruction in it, but nothing serious.
But it's still there.
So yeah, it is still there. And we're excited to going back to our normal life, to our education, our jobs. The warm atmosphere of Gaza, the simple warm atmosphere of it that we have been denied from for too long, that we did not think this day would come ever.
How quickly do you think you can get back there to your house?
Well, as they said, we could go back next Sunday. We will be allowed to go back to the north. Today, people from who have been displaced from Rafah and Khan Yunis, the southern of the Strip, they went back home today. Mm-hmm. I envied them, actually. It has been a great moment of joy, and the population here in Deir al-Balah is decreasing because Deir al-Balah had like over 2 million displaced people in it from all around the Strip.
This is only the first phase of the ceasefire. This stage has an end date. You've seen Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and others say that the war could begin again at any moment, but hearing in your voice and hearing what you're saying, it seems to me like you're feeling hopeful that this can be permanent.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, literally, I don't know if it will. Peace seems very fragile to me right now.
Yeah.
Because both parties did not get what they want out of this war. I don't like to talk politics. I'm not that into them. But always we fall as the victim, the people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think peace at this point is very fragile. And in my opinion, I don't think it will last for a long time. But hopefully, I hope it does.
When you do get back to Gaza City, when you do get back to your house, what are your immediate plans? What would you like to do? What are you hoping to do?
Well, at first, I'm going to take a long walk in all the neighborhoods, all of the streets that I used to walk in daily and I have not seen for 15 months. I'm going to take a walk. I'm going to clean the house that have not been touched by any human for over 15 months, and that is going to be extremely difficult job. And to go back to my education, to see my room, to enter the house that I have been raised in and born in, to see our neighbors. A lot of people have stayed there in our neighborhood, and I don't know, so many things. To go back to the university, but it's bombed, unfortunately. So I think we will be continuing to studying online, but I'm just so excited to be over with this nightmare.
And just speaking for you personally, I'm wondering what your long-term hopes are for the future of Gaza City.
I really hope that we maintain this peace, try to maintain it by just considering that every time the normal people, they fall for victim. We get affected the most out of this war, the children, the women. So I really hope that the international community try to preserve this peace for as long as they can.
That's Noor El-Hassi, a student and journalist who lives in Gaza. Thank you for talking to us on this first day of the ceasefire.
Thank you.
Artificial intelligence is changing the way that countries spy on each other and gather intelligence. That's according to Anne Neuberger, who's the Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emerging Technology. In a new piece in Foreign Affairs, she argues the U.S. needs to prepare for the threats that AI poses to national security, and that the U.S. has a lot of work to do to benefit from this technology and protect itself from bad actors. Anne Neuberger joins me now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
It's good to be here with you.
I think a lot of people listening are thinking about AI or interacting with AI through chatbots, things like ChatGPT, right? You are arguing AI in a different way as a useful tool in espionage. Can you start by just explaining how and why?
Absolutely. So think about a group of intelligence analysts who are trying to see if a given country will be doing a missile launch in the next few days. So they'll use a combination of imagery, taking pictures of the area, of signals collection, individuals who may be part of that role and listening to their planning work, and they work to bring that together, and they work to do that quickly to provide, for example, warning to a community that's looking to defend against those potential missiles. Artificial intelligence both allows to compress that, to deliver it more quickly, and to also integrate across those different intelligence disciplines quickly.
I think TikTok is in the news and in people's minds in a lot of ways in recent days. Is that one of the areas that you're thinking about as you write this, as you've crafted these policies?
The danger of TikTok is it is the major platform by which Americans, young Americans, are gaining their news. TikTok and the company have the Chinese government itself censors information it provides its own citizens. So the risk that in a country like America, in a democracy where each person's voice and vote matters, that a platform where Americans are getting their primary source of information is controlled by a country that censors the information for its own people, that's a significant risk.
This is a field that is changing so rapidly, week to week, month to month, major changes over the course of the Biden administration. Obviously, that comes to a close, and a new set of people are coming in and taking on posts like yours. What would you say to somebody stepping into the job? Like, what are the things that have been top of your mind that you think that makes the most sense to be thinking about as you're trying to craft policy in an area like this?
Using AI to more quickly pull information together, whether it's images or voice, to pull that together to alert on a potential threat and avoid a terror attack, avoid a cyber attack. There's tremendous promise in sense making of that. And on the flip side,
can I actually hop in on one follow up though? Just there's obviously a big upside to quickly identifying threats, but when a specific person is flagged as a threat and they are not in fact a threat, there are tremendous downsides as well. How do you balance the speed of the analysis with making sure big mistakes aren't being made?
I talk about in the piece, the United States must challenge ourselves to be first. First to benefit from AI, first to protect itself from enemies who might use it, and first to use AI in line with the laws and values of a democracy, because those risks you talk about are real, and we need to build the protections for that and a constant evaluation, it's not a one-time thing, into that to ensure we're doing so in line with who we are as Americans.
That's Anne Neuberger, Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emerging Technology on the U.S. National Security Council in the outgoing Biden administration. Her piece in Foreign Affairs is titled Spy versus AI, How Artificial Intelligence Will Remake Espionage. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
President-elect Donald Trump is getting ready for his second inauguration tomorrow in a lot of different ways. You've probably heard about his victory rally today here in Washington, D.C., but here's one you might have missed. On Friday night, Trump launched his own official meme coin. It's a kind of cryptocurrency. And after the launch, its value has soared and soared, generating billions of dollars out of essentially thin air. Brady Dale covers crypto markets for Axios and joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start out with the real basics, because this is a booming industry. There's so much activity here, but it still confuses a lot of people. Can you just walk us through what exactly a meme coin is, how it differs from basic cryptocurrency?
Sure. A meme coin is a coin that's just meant to represent an idea. So, you know, folks often like to say that there's nothing undergirding cryptocurrency, and, you know, that's a debatable point. But with meme coins, it really is just like, this is your way to buy into a concept. So, like, the most famous one is Dogecoin, and the idea there is just, we like that Doge meme. And if you have this coin, then you're sort of backing that concept. And, you know, meme coins kind of really came into their own last year. They were a fun way to sort of track how the candidates were doing, because there was multiple meme coins, unofficial meme coins for every one of them. Mm-hmm. And so you could really see that, like, when certain events happen, it would be reflected in the market. And that sort of began to give a lot of people the idea, like, oh, meme coins really can follow the news.
So is this, should we think of it as like a fandom thing? Or I'm sure there's also people trying to buy and bank on this and trade on this too, right?
I think there's a lot of reasons why people are buying this. I think those are correct. You know, I think folks expect that this coin will end up tracking the Trump presidency. So if he has great moments, it should go up in value. If it has bad moments, they might think that's a good time to buy. If he talks about it, that's something I'm really watching. If he talks about his coin in some official capacity, that will probably cause some kind of spike. You know, who knows how big. But another thing to keep in mind, which I think is maybe the most powerful part of this story, is celebrities who have launched meme coins in the past have often used them as a way of giving access to their biggest fans. Mm-hmm. We've already seen Trump do a version of this. You know, when he sort of announced that he liked crypto for the first time last year, it was a gathering of people who had his NFT trading cards. And so it's really a way to give his base a financial incentive to stick with him and possibly to hold the closest ones closer to him.
So what are your biggest questions going forward with not only this particular meme coin, but this broader trend that it's a big part of?
My biggest question with this particular meme coin is, does Trump actually promote it himself, you know, from his official capacity as a president? Because that will be very powerful for holders of the coin and something that people will want to trade around. And then my other big question is, you know, if at some point there isn't a congressional response to this, if there aren't, like, you know, new rules specifically about the kind of things that politicians can do, because it's so surprising and kind of unbelievable. I think it's something that lawmakers are going to need to grapple with going forward.
Right, because there were so many examples the first time he was president of Trump going around ethical standards in terms of, you know, personally making money. Here he is the second time around, suddenly billions of dollars appearing
with something like this that's so new that there aren't that many regulations in place.
And this is like, it's one thing to like buy a bunch of hotel rooms, but you can only do that every so often. You can buy in and out of this every single day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You know, if you got a meeting with Trump or someone in his circle, you know, you might buy 1,000 meme coins just to walk in there and say you did it and see if that makes them smile, you know. And then if it doesn't, you can just sell it a minute later. You know, it's just, it really monetizes the attention he's able to generate in a way that we've just never seen anything like this before. It's going to be a very interesting story to watch.
That's Brady Dale, crypto reporter for Axios. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. British actress Joan Plowright brought stage and screen characters to life for more than six decades before her death on Thursday at 95. She won a Tony Award as a pregnant teenager in A Taste of Honey in 1960 and was nominated for an Oscar as a stern widow in Enchanted April in 1991. But as NPR's Bob Nondello remembers, she was more than just the sum of the parts she played.
Supremely dignified in her later years, Joan Plowright was decidedly nasal when she first made an impression on movie audiences as the adoring granddaughter of Laurence Olivier's title character in The Entertainer.
See you, Senator. I haven't got my glasses.
I know you've never seen him.
The two had also appeared in the stage version, and though they were in character, the play captured something about them. Olivier was a classical acting legend at that point. Plowright, who was 22 years younger, represented a new generation of method actors. So when they married a year after the film came out, that dynamic helped put a stamp on Britain's new national theater company. Sometimes he was the established box office draw, she the forceful new face, say in Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, where she played Portia to his Shylock.
Take thou thy pound of flesh, but in the cutting it, if thou dost shed one drop of Christian blood, thy lands and goods are by the laws of Venice confiscate unto
other times the state she was the draw and he the support in such mid-century modern melodramas as Saturday, Sunday, Monday, which chronicled Plowright's constantly frustrated efforts to put a big Italian dinner on the table.
You can chop off my hands if I ever set foot in this kitchen again. My daughter goes out because she cannot stand the smell of onions. My husband cannot stand the stink of calamari.
I caught this one in 1974 because it featured Olivier as the family patriarch, but I came out marveling at Plowright. Director Franco Zeffirelli staged the curtain call so that the cast members took their bows all with silverware or napkins in hand and then started setting a big stage-wide table. When Plowright finally came out with a huge platter of spaghetti topped with a sauce we'd smelled her simmering all evening, the audience stood and cheered. After Olivier's death in 1989, Plowright finally came into her own as a film star in everything from Dennis the Menace, where she played the patient wife of Walter Matthau's constantly fuming Mr. Wilson, to Enchanted April, where her stern, hilariously erudite widow...
All I wish to do is sit in the shade and remember better times and better men.
...won her an Oscar nomination.
Did you know Keats?
Keats? No, I didn't. And I didn't know Shakespeare or Chaucer either.
Plowright finally had to retire from acting in 2014 after macular degeneration left her legally blind. But she was as amusing as she'd ever been a few years later, appearing as herself.
One of my hearing aids is gone. What have we just done?
In the TV documentary, Nothing Like a Dame, gossiping, swapping tales, and cracking wise with fellow acting legends Maggie Smith and Judi Dench.
It's just what was the last thing said?
Are we going to go on working forever, Joan?
Oh, my agent in America said to me one day, when he knew I couldn't do very much because of the eyesight going, and he said, well, we'll look around for a nice little cameo that Judi Dench hasn't got her paws on.
The title got it right. Nothing Like a Dame, especially when that dame is Joan Plowright.
How rude.
I'm Bob Mandela.
That's not rude at all.
Very, very rude.
Well, well say
America, darling, that's how they talk.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
President-elect Trump will be inaugurated on Martin Luther King Day. On this holiday, we'll be discussing how the soon-to-be president's proposed policies have evolved in the last 8 years and what Senator Raphael Warnock, who is a pastor at the same church Martin Luther King preached at, tells us about what he's learned from King's teachings. Monday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. President Biden says the guns in Gaza have gone silent and that the ceasefire agreement he first put forward in May has come to fruition. Three Israeli hostages were released today and are back in Israel. Biden says it was one of the toughest negotiations he's been a part of. TikTok is back online for millions of Americans after shutting down last night because of a new federal law requiring it to be sold or banned. The app credited President-elect Trump, who said on social media he would give them an extension and that there would be no liability for companies helping TikTok stay on. And at the weekend box office, the buddy comedy One of Them Days debuted in the top spot with an estimated $11.6 million in ticket sales. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org. From Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at cigna.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Located on the grounds of one of the world's largest women's prisons, there is a firehouse staffed entirely by incarcerated people. Firehouse 5 is home to a squad known as the Fire Girls. Journalist Anna Sussman has been reporting on the prison for 15 years.
And when I realized that due to the nature of prison towns, the women were put in the position of being the rescuers of their jailers, I wanted to hear as many stories and as many voices from that experience as I could.
California's inmate fire program is 100 years old, but it has been in the news again because over 1,000 incarcerated people have been sent to fight the ongoing wildfires in Southern California. Anna Sussman's new podcast, Fire Escape, follows the story of one woman, Amika Moda, who learned to fight fires while serving a 7-year sentence for vehicular manslaughter. We talked with Sussman and Moda about the podcast. So there's one moment in the podcast, Amika, you're fighting this out-of-control fire, and you feel like the fire captain is giving you dangerous orders. Can you set the scene for us? Can you tell us what was going on, what the captain was telling you to do?
Yes, it was a really large slough fire, which is a type of agricultural fire that we see often in the Central Valleys. And we were instructed by our captain to pull our hoses across active burn. And it was something that I was, you know, very aware that was not something we were supposed to do. And it was this, the complexity of our captain, who was also a correctional officer, giving us a direct order. So that was the situation. We were watching it unfold, just knowing how unsafe it was, but we did initially proceed.
Let's listen to that moment from the podcast.
The fire comes sweeping through. The fire kind of did this boom there, and the trees caught the next trees, and it's coming across the bank. All of it is so fast. The hoses are drawn out across the slough. You know the girls are going to lose their equipment. So I'm thinking of the girls. I'm thinking about protecting the truck and our water source. I'm thinking about our
radios that we can't, like, communicate well on.
And then she tried again to radio the women behind the fire line.
I answered to a correctional officer and a captain, but I also had people that I was responsible for. I had to just override this captain and do what was safest for the crew.
She called the women back from the front lines.
I mean, the reality of, like, overriding a captain on a fire ground is that you could get sent back in. So, like, the captain and what he's saying, because that don't make no sense. And just as clearly and methodically and carefully as we can make decisions that will get us home safe, that's what that moment at the slough fire was.
Amika, can you tell us more about that power dynamic? At one point in the podcast, you call it a bit of a dance, and it just seems like such a tricky thing to navigate.
It is such a tricky thing to navigate. You know, we are in charge of our crews. You know, my first job was to make sure that everybody was safe. And it was difficult, right? Because we often were answering to folks that, you know, we didn't always trust to be making the best decisions for us. You know, that was true inside of the prisons as well. So there was definitely this dynamic that we held as incarcerated people trying to figure out what our actual power was in a situation. And, you know, so it was definitely something we navigated the whole time.
I want to ask you both about this, and Anna, I want to start with you since you've been reporting on this so much. Like I said, so many people around the country are really learning about this program through the LA fires, and there's been a renewed round of criticism saying, you know, like Amika, like you're talking about, there's a lack of individual agency to make decisions just due to the basic setup of it, right? It's incredibly dangerous work. Inmates only earn a few dollars a day. Anna, what do you make of all of that criticism and skepticism of the ethics of this program to begin with?
I think the criticism is healthy and well-deserved. I think when it comes to the fire program, it's important to hold two truths at the same time, which is that it offers a lot of opportunity both to incarcerated folks and to the rest of us as a model for kind of what can be for incarcerated folks. And I think it's a really problematic program in which people put their lives on the line with no protections. So I think we can do better.
Amika, what are your thoughts, having been in this position, on the pros and cons of this program?
What I would never want to do is discount what it feels like in the moment to participate in that program, because people are seeking something other than the horrific conditions that we are coming from inside those prison walls. So people are excited to get to the fire camp or get to the firehouse. They're excited to be out there and serving in the community. You know, and that's some personal context. But if you zoom out a bit and look at the collective structure of the program and the way that we have commodified incarcerated bodies to support the labor force in California, it's extremely problematic. And we leave with very little. We don't have any wages that support us, and it is really difficult to transfer into these type of jobs when we're released.
I want to listen to another moment from the podcast. There's a scene where the firefighters are responding to a car accident. Turns out the people in the crash are the daughter and granddaughter of one of the correctional officers at the prison. And Amika, you recognize this correctional officer, and early in the series, you called him a stickler. You said he wasn't abusive to you like other correctional officers or COs, but it was still somebody you tried to avoid. And on this scene of this accident, you have this complicated moment with him. Let's listen.
And the emotion coming from him, you know, to see his family being, you know, pretty injured and being life-flighted out. And for him to actually show those emotions in front of us was pretty intense too, because they don't do that, right? Yeah, it's his daughter and his granddaughter, and so he was in tears.
Did he become more of a human?
Yeah, because you could see expressions you wouldn't see on the inside. You know, seeing fear, seeing tears, seeing somebody in the place of being a caregiver and loving on their children. Like, we certainly don't see that piece on the inside.
After Amika and the firefighters got both mom and baby to safety, she picked up the metal wrappers and the bits of broken car and climbed back into the truck and headed to the prison. And she kept thinking about the CO in the green uniform.
I felt like, I hope you know I loved your child just the way I would love my child. You know, I hope that they saw that in us. It was like a strange and beautiful thing. You know, it was humanity.
But even in that fragile moment, this man was still her jailer.
Amika, is there anything you want to add to the feelings that we heard you say about that particular moment and the broader dynamic that came up again and again on this job?
I mean, what I would say is that, you know, in these moments of life or death situations, whether they're car accidents, fires, medical calls, we've laid down our armor and the masks that we wear inside to protect ourselves as human beings on both sides, as incarcerated people and correctional officers. We're there to do the work, and the dynamic is hugely different than it is on the inside.
That is Amika Mota along with Anna Sussman talking about the new podcast Fire Escape from Snap Studios at KQED and Wondery. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks for having us, Scott.
Thank you so much.
TikTok is back online in the U.S. It was offline for about 14 hours due to a ban on the social media app unless it's sold by its Chinese parent company. A statement today on TikTok's X account reads, quote, "We thank President Trump for providing the necessary clarity and assurance to our service providers that they will face no penalties." They're referring to a statement the president-elect put out today. In it, he said that he will issue an executive order on Monday to delay the ban. However, the app remains unavailable in the Google and Apple app stores. Stay with NPR for the latest on this developing story. For much of the history of top-level college football, the national champion was decided by a vote. And that led to a lot of endless arguing, which sports fans love, but it was often unsatisfying. And then, even when a playoff was created, for years it was just two teams, and then it was only four. Now, the first year of a new era of the sport is about to come to a close. The championship game for the first ever 12-team playoff is tomorrow, and two of the most storied programs in college sports will meet. NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan is here to talk about us. Hey there.
What's up, Scott?
We got Notre Dame and Ohio State heavyweight, two schools that, I'll put it this way, sure inspire strong feelings.
I think that's right, and maybe no stronger feelings than among the ESPN executives who could only dream of this matchup when they signed the contract to air this championship game. Yeah, I mean, these are the two of the best-known programs in all of college football. Really, they're just like not just storied programs, the biggest brands, I think. Anybody who knows any Catholic people will know that Notre Dame is a big deal. Ohio State, obviously huge, not just in Ohio, across the Midwest, across the country. And I think this season, both of these teams belong in this game without a doubt. Ohio State, simply just one of the most complete teams in the country, filled with NFL talent. The offense especially is great. They have this incredible freshman wide receiver, number four, Jeremiah Smith, who is a true freshman. He's 19 years old. He, some NFL analysts say, would go first in the NFL draft this season if he were eligible. He's not. So instead, we just get to watch him torch older players in college football games for the next couple seasons. But I also think maybe Ohio State is a little more mistake prone. Their quarterback, Will Howard, seems good for at least kind of one ugly interception every game, it seems like. On the other hand, you have Notre Dame, much more of an old school football team. They really play, dominate at the line of scrimmage, have a very tough defense. They rely heavily on the run game. Maybe overall the offense is a little less capable of the big explosive plays that Ohio State can do. So it may come down to whether Ohio State can play a mistake-free game or not.
I think the interesting thing about this is for so long you won a national championship in college football by having a perfect season. You can have a single mistake, right?
Yep.
Now you have this big playoff, and that creates the unpredictability of a big playoff. You make one mistake, and that's it. You're done. I mean, are these the two teams that everybody expected would be in the championship, or did we see some twists and turns?
They're certainly two extremely good teams, and I think in that sense it's not a surprise. They were good all season long. On the other hand, you know, this playoff system, as you say, like allowed for some of that unpredictability. The Oregon Ducks were the team that were undefeated going into this. They were the number one team for most of the season. And yet Ohio State in the quarter final just like waltzed past them to reach this stage. And then the other thing I would say is maybe a little bit of a surprise is all season long and all every season you hear about how the Southeastern Conference, the SEC, is where the best football in the country is played, where those teams are the best. And, you know, not this year. Like, yeah. Neither of these teams are SEC teams, and the only SEC team that reached the semifinals was the University of Texas, who is brand new to the SEC. So all these longtime schools like Alabama and Georgia, I mean, Alabama didn't even make the playoffs. So the fact that it's these two teams, Ohio State and Notre Dame, you know, as you were alluding to, like, the fact that they got to the playoffs this year and the fact that they're in the title game, it reflects just how big of a sea change this whole 12-team playoff is for college football. Notre Dame lost their second game of the season to, you know, a kind of like mid-major squad, Northern Illinois. That loss probably would have put them out of contention right. for the playoff in the previous iterations of it. Ohio State dropped a November game to a very mediocre Michigan team this year. That loss would have put them out of contention for the playoff in a previous year. So the fact that they're both here, despite losing those stinkers, is evidence of how this playoff has changed things.
So let's talk about this whole system, this whole 12-team playoff for a second. I know I personally have really enjoyed it. I liked watching competitive December first-round games that wasn't some sort of lame bowl that 20 people are in the stands for. Build-up mm-hmm. and as the field is narrowed has been exciting to watch. Mm-hmm. Is that universal? Are there any problems with this, or are people by and large happy with this new system?
I think overall it's been good. I'll say that. But I think those first round games were a bit lopsided. There mm-hmm. was a lot of lopsided final scores. A bunch of those games were blowouts where the team that was expected to win just rolled to a win. That may have contributed to kind of TV ratings that I think have maybe been a little disappointing. The semifinals were actually down from the semifinals last year. I'm also personally a little sad that none of the big long shots were able to make a Cinderella run the kind of thing you see in college basketball. Which I think makes March Madness really fun. We didn't get to see any of that in college football. The other thing I'll note is that the top four seeds all had a bye week. They had a week off, but then they all lost, which makes you wonder if that was too much time off. So I think going forward, we're certainly very unlikely to go back to a 4-team playoff. So I think 12 teams or more is here to stay, but we might see some tweaks to the way the seeding works going forward.
It's great to welcome another sport to the our buys actually hurtful for teams that baseball's been totally talking about for years. So you tick through some of the wrinkles. What about the positives?
I mean, the positives, I mean, to me, the games have just gotten better and better as the playoffs have kept going. The semifinals were great. Ohio State versus Texas, fantastic game. Penn State versus Notre Dame, also fantastic game. Both of them came down to the final minutes. I was on the edge of my seat mm-hmm. the whole time for both games. And then also, just to shout out one of the quarterfinal games, one of the best college football games I think I've ever seen was between Texas and Arizona State. It went to two overtimes, neck and neck the entire game. And Arizona State specifically is a team that just wouldn't have sniffed the playoff in the previous format. But they got in and they went toe-to-toe with Texas in one of the most exciting games ever. And I think that alone justifies this bigger playoff field. When you get games like that are exciting all the way to the end. Overall, I think this is successful and interesting. And personally, I'm really excited to watch Monday's game. Notre Dame, Ohio State, it should be a great one.
NPR's Becky Sullivan, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
For Sunday, that is All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow. Be sure to tune in to NPR tomorrow. Morning Edition hosts Michelle Martin and Steve Inskeep will host live special coverage of Donald Trump's presidential inauguration. They'll be joined by NPR reporters and special guests to break down the highlights of the presidential transition and provide insights about the first day of Trump's second go-round as president. We hope you'll join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Forester with an updated exterior design and an 11.6-inch Starlink multimedia interface. Learn more at Subaru.com. From the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
no matter what you say or do, I know our love will linger when the other love falls.